This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
This is From Textbooks to Interactive Learning Materials, Principles of Biology. So I want to welcome Vikram Savkar. He is the Publishing Director of Nature Education, which is part of the Nature Publishing Group. I'm not going to read his complete biography, but you should know he is really no slouch, having done everything from receiving 2 degrees at Harvard in physics and classics, working as an assistant to the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic, but most recently as senior vice president and publishing director at Nature. So I want to welcome Vikram, and we will pause at the end for some questions and answers. Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you to Bill, who is somewhere, for the kind invitation to speak to all of you today. And thank you especially to all of you for taking the time to come listen. I have a slight cold, so I apologize if my voice is a little gravelly, but with this bottle of water, I think we'll get through the day. I am going to speak to you today about Principles of Biology, an online interactive textbook or beyond the textbook in college-level biology, and the first of what we intend to be a program of such textbooks across all the life and physical sciences. And in the course of talking about this, I'm going to touch on many ways in which this book, this initiative, is unusual. The first way in which it's unusual is that it's published by a company that is not really traditionally a textbook publisher, Nature Publishing Group, which is where I work. For those of you who don't know, Nature Publishing Group is best known as the publisher of Nature, our flagship scientific research magazine, which we've published since 1869, and which is one of the premier places in the world for top scientists to publish their latest research for other scientists to read. We also have a number of other scientific magazines, such as Scientific American, which I'm sure many of you read, and 40 or 50 other journals in nearly every field of science, nature biology, nature genetics, and so on and so forth, in which scientists publish the latest discoveries in their field. So how did a journals publisher, a publisher that's publishing material for PhDs, for researchers who are working in their labs, end up publishing a biology textbook? Well, in 2007, we decided to create an entirely new division called Nature Education, which was exclusively dedicated to publishing science education and specifically innovative science education. I'm not going to go into too much detail on why we decided to create this division, but the essence of it is, as we looked at our corporate strategy for the next 100 years, as a very old privately owned publisher, we tend to think about things in terms of centuries. As we looked at our strategy for the next 100 years, we felt that it would be incomplete of us to be based around journals and not play a major role in helping make sure that the world's young become the next generation of scientists who publish the papers that we publish in our journals and who read the papers we publish in our journals. If you look at the quality of science education worldwide, there's reason to be concerned. And so we decided we were going to address that concern, and we were going to play a role in every country in the world, helping to inspire the younger generations and prepare them to become high-performing scientists, publishing high-quality research, solving key global problems. That's the short story of why Nature Education exists. And as we thought about what Nature Education should do, we split its mission into two parts. We divided the world, roughly speaking, into mature markets, the United States, the UK, Europe, Japan. These are mature scientific markets, and developing markets, sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, Latin America, and so on and so forth. And it was very clear when we set out that these two global segments had very different needs. And so we defined two pronged goals. Our first goal was for the mature markets, for the developed markets, to lead the way in publishing 21st century science textbooks. Textbooks that meaningfully engage, inspire, educate today's students, 21st century students. Now, what that means, I'm going to get into in great length later. So I'll pass on for now. The second piece of our goal was in the developing world to develop a strategy for broadening access to high-quality educational information to all students, regardless of where they lived, what gender they are, what their socioeconomic status is. So in the developed world, our goal is to take the textbook forward and make it more effective. In the developing world, our goal was equity of access. I'm going to speak first now a little bit about our focus on the developing world. I'm going to touch on it only briefly because it's not our main topic today, and then I'm going to move back for the remainder of the talk to talk about interactive textbooks. So when we were thinking about broadening access to educational information throughout the developing world, we settled on open education as our main strategy. I suspect that many people in this room know what open education is. Some of you may not. So open education means publishing high-quality content at no cost to the end user and finding a sustainable way to do that. But as we defined open education, we wanted it to mean more than just content. So in December 2008 and 2009, really, we published our flagship website in open education, which is called Citable. And Citable has three main parts. The first part is a rich library of content, more than 2,000 pieces that were specially created for this open education website in a range of fields in the advanced life sciences, in our case, genetics, cell biology, and so on. All of this content is created by our editorial team, subjected to an exhaustive peer review process, and therefore is of very high quality. And all of it is available to all end users for free. The second component of Citable is a community. The community of all the users and all the consumers of that content, whom we exposed to each other as they were consuming that content. We grouped the users of that content around each other as if around a watering hole and created tools that enabled them to get to know each other and to collaborate. This community is teachers, scientists, researchers, students, younger students, parents, anybody who had a need for this open content. We let them see who each other were. We created tools that allowed them to connect synchronously, like chat, instant conferencing, messaging, and asynchronously, the ability to create a network and send each other notes and work together offline. And we let them do what they wanted. We think of this as creating a global classroom, uniting all the people who care about common scientific topics into a single, floating in the clouds, global classroom. The third main component of Citable are tools. Teaching tools that allow instructors to run an effective class using this open content, that allow them to assign a lesson plan or build a custom book or keep track of grades. Learning tools that allow students to build personalized learning paths. So this combination of content, community, and tools defined what we thought of as open education. We published that at the end of 2008, as I mentioned. It's grown steadily, and at this point, more than 500,000 students use our materials every month. For us, that's a lot. Genetics and advanced cell biology is not American Idol. So half million students is actually a pretty meaningful share of the students throughout the developing world who are studying those topics. And they and their teachers have found their way to the site and are continuing to use it, and it grows steadily. I'm sure some of you are wondering how we afford to publish this material for free. And the answer is that we have a program of corporate sponsorships. Biopharma corporations like Roche and Novartis and some technology corporations like Intel have given healthy support to this, in return for which we give them some branding visibility in the site. They are not allowed to advertise their products. They are allowed to talk about their corporate values, their support of the community, their support of the education. And I can tell you, in the more than 3 years that we've operated the site, we've never received a single complaint from any student or teacher about seeing a Roche or Novartis brand in the site, because we explain to them very clearly that these are the companies that are allowing us to bring them this content for free. So that is open education, and I'm happy to answer questions about that if you want to know more about that when we get to the end. But now I'm going to turn to the main topic today, which is our interactive textbooks. Principles of Biology is the first, and we intend to publish a number more. And what I want to do is bring you a little bit into our thought process that led us to publish this textbook, which is forward-looking, which is a bit radical. Before I get to describing what it is and how it works, I want to help you understand how we got there, why we got there. And the essential point that I want to make is that we never set out to do something radical, to do something innovative, to do something groundbreaking. That wasn't our goal. If anybody feels that it is any of those things, that's an incidental outcome. What we did intend to do is to create a new textbook that was exactly aligned to the needs of today's consumers, That's all. We wanted to understand as deeply as we could who are 21st century students, who are 21st century teachers, and what kind of product is the ideal product for them. Our method was to define core values. What were the core values that we think our market expects? What were the core values that we wanted to make sure that our product lived up to? We operated from those values, and everything else flowed deterministically from there. Whatever the book turned out to be is not because we looked at our competitors and thought, how can we differentiate ourselves from our competitors? How can we get a little bit ahead? Or how can we create an advantage that opens a market niche or a market space for us? Those things were truly incidental. We asked, what are our values, and what does a product look like that lives up to those values? So what are our values? Well, I'm going to start by talking first about what we kind of wanted to stay away from because they characterize the problems of textbooks today. There are many challenges of textbooks today, but I've isolated just four. One that you'll hear a lot of people in our industry and in textbooks talk about is poor sell-through. For those of you who aren't from the education space, what that means to us is that if there's a class of 100 students who are all meant to buy a textbook, maybe only 30 or 40 of them will actually buy that textbook. And the other 70 might rent a copy of the book, they might buy a used book, they might photocopy a book, they might pirate a book, or they might do without. So it's very difficult to run a business when you make about 30% of the revenue that you actually thought you were going to make, and that's pretty much the standard situation today. And if you ask a lot of people why only 30% of the students are buying the book, they may say used books or piracy or rentals or leakage from international editions and so on. And to me, none of that is the answer. Those are all incidental. The reason why only 30% of the students are buying the book is because they're apathetic about it. It's that simple. If they were really excited about the book, if they were excited about the value it brought them, about the experience they had with the book, they would buy the book. So the fact that they're looking at alternatives, considering alternatives, means that that product that we're delivering to them is not succeeding in exciting them, in firing their imagination. So apathy, I think, is the first value that we want to stay away from when we're coming up with 21st century textbooks. The second is complicated user experience. In this industry, we figured out 20 years ago that, of course, we had to jump on digital. And publishers created really exciting companion websites to books. And then the market changed again, and publishers figured out that you had to have videos and tutorials. So we created a video and tutorial product. And then things evolved more, and we figured out that you had to have assessments. So we created lots of good assessment tools. And we figured out that students wanted to research online, so we created an online researcher. And now, if you're a student and you buy a textbook, you actually get a textbook, and shrink-wrapped along with that textbook is about 10 different things. Every single one of which is fantastic and beautiful. But how many students really want to sift through 10 different products in the course of a day? The answer is almost none. So all of those fantastic assets that we publish as textbook publishers largely lie fallow and unused. So the complexity of that user experience that makes students not take up the value that we invest in as publishers is another one of those things that we wanted to stay away from. Third thing is the cost, and I'm actually not talking about the cost of the book. I'm talking about something else. As we publishers have gone digital, we've had to keep up with technological change. So when the internet came around, we had to create websites. Then something else came around, mobile phones came around, and we had to do something for mobile phones. Then tablets came around, and we had to do something for tablets. And then Android came around, we had to do something for that kind of tablet. And more devices are coming around. And every time something came around, as publishers, we had to reinvest in creating a version of our content and of our product for that platform. Well, this is very expensive, and it's ultimately unsustainable. As publishers, we can't publish 85 versions of everything we have. So one of the things we wanted to stay away from is avoiding getting into a situation of an arms race, of making commitments to the market that we could not possibly afford to keep in the long run. And the fourth, I'm not going to talk about very much because it's very specific to education. I suspect that a lot of people in the room aren't necessarily from the education space. But digital creates an opportunity to manage big data, big volumes of data about student performance that can be leveraged very, very powerfully to help institutions and faculty and even students themselves understand how to improve their curricula. And some products are starting to do that a little bit, but I think as a whole, as an industry, we have a long way to go to make this a reality. So those were the the challenges that we kept in mind. What were the values that we defined that we wanted our new product to live up to? There are four main ones that I'm going to isolate here. There are many more than this, but there are four. The first is that we wanted our textbook to be born digital, and I'm going to talk about all of these in a minute. The second is that we wanted it to be user-friendly. And if you look back at the top four bullets, each of these is in some way the opposite. If one problem is apathy because the product isn't really a good fit in the digital world, we wanted our textbook to be born digital so that it's truly exciting. If one of the problems is that the user experience is too complicated, we wanted our product to be very, very user-friendly. As user-friendly as a book. A book is a very user-friendly technology. We wanted our online book to be the same way. The third value is that we wanted our book to be skills-oriented. I'm not going to talk too much about this. It's very specific to science. But we wanted our students not just to memorize things, but to come out the other side able to do science, to become scientists. And the fourth point is that we wanted our products to be affordable for the students and for us as the publisher. So let me dive in. Born digital. What does born digital mean? Born digital means not repurposing, not writing and authoring content for a print paradigm and then figuring out how to republish that in a number of digital book formats. It means creating a product from day one, from the first moment of its conception, for a purely, exclusively digital life. Born digital publishing means going back to your editorial team, which is what I had to do, build our editorial team from scratch to create content specifically for a digital world. What does that mean? In the digital world, people expect all content to be easily customizable. It can't be fixed. People want to rearrange it in whatever order they want. They want to be able to modify it however they want. And once they're done mucking it up, they want it still to make sense. So how do you author content with the assumption that people can muck it up however they want and it still makes sense? I can tell you it doesn't look like authoring a traditional textbook chapter. You have to really go back to the roots and think about what is the structure of our content that will allow this to happen. People expect content to be multimedia, not to read some text here and go to another place and watch a video, but they expect us to make decisions about the best way for them to learn something. And if that way is video, then we should teach it only through video. And if that best way is text, then teach it only through text. They want us to make intelligent decisions about how to use everything that digital can do to teach them. They want it to be interactive. They want it to be intertextual. That's what born digital publishing means. There's a constellation of information out there in the internet. Millions of websites full of good scientific information. It's a mistake for us to think that our book can be the be-all, end-all for these students. It's a gateway. It's a starting place. And we need to use the book to launch them out into that universe of information. And the book needs to intelligently organize all that information out there in the world for them so that through our book they can learn much, much more than they would through any book. I'm not going to talk too much about this, but hopefully you see what I mean by creating content that is born digital has nothing to do with technical formats. It has nothing to do with MP3s. It has nothing to do with do we use Cork or InDesign or do we use HTML or do we use XML. It has nothing to do with anything of that. It has to do with the editorial team and the authors sitting down and asking themselves, if this is the medium through which content is consumed by people, what are the inherent structures of the content I need to create so that it can work successfully in that way? And believe me, this was a challenge because we took people from the textbook industry and we had to relearn this way of thinking together. The second value was user-friendly. And what that means is, as I mentioned, that you have a seamless workflow. Rather than going to 10 different places, everything should be in one simple place. You should be directed as a reader just as you are in a good old-fashioned print book. It also means that you can access the information in our book anytime, anywhere. That's a basic expectation of user experience. Without having to jump through hoops, without having to go through bells and whistles, it should be as easy for me to access my book over there on that device as it is over here on this device. Skills-oriented. I'm going to pass over this quickly, but what that value means is connecting our students with those things that are beyond the book that help them become real scientists, with primary literature from our archives, with data sets, with tools, with virtual labs, with simulations, building that into the core workflow. And the fourth value is affordable. We wanted it to be affordable to the student. What does affordable mean? It means simply that the price reverses that apathy that I spoke about. That instead of feeling that they're getting less than they paid for, we want students to feel that they got everything that they paid for, more than they paid for. That the price is based on value. And that at the end of the year, when the student looks back and asks how much he or she paid and how much he or she learned, has no problem recommending that same purchase to anybody else. In our case, by the way, that meant we wanted the book to be available to students who bought it for a lifetime, not for a year, not for 2 years. It's not a rental. It's not a lease. It's a lifetime access to the book. So with those four values in mind, we set about creating our new book, and that book is Principles of Biology, the first textbook in our Principles of Science program. Principles of Biology consists of about 200 modules, each of which is a self-contained learning experience that guides the student from basic concepts through mastery of rich concepts, through tests, summative assessments, and finally to review of that material. These modules can be arranged by instructors in any order they want, and everything about the book automatically reshapes and renumbers as the instructors do that on the fly, so that the book is always true, never feels like a Franken-book. The book is accessible, not just on the desktop and laptop, but automatically accessible on just about any mobile device, through smartphones, through tablets, wherever the student is, logs on and gets it. There's no apps that anybody needs to download. They just go to the same URL as the main book and they access it automatically. I'm going to speak about that a bit more a little bit later. The students can download a printable version of the entire book and print it on their own. Yes, despite the fact that our previous guest didn't like books, my experience is that, at least in higher ed, there are plenty of students who still like to read things on paper, and we're perfectly aware of the need to facilitate that. We just don't want to be in the printing business. We're in the content creation and distribution business, and so we allow our students to download a PDF, a nice four-color laid-out version of the book, and print it as they need. They can even take it to their local Kinko's and print it, and we give them the authorization to do that. Kinko's can charge them whatever we want. We don't want to be a part of that transaction. That's not where we want to make our money as publishers. And there is a downloadable version of the entire book that students can store on their desktop or laptop, that they can read when they're not able to be connected to the internet. So they can read the book, they can take the tests. So we've made it possible for them to have a primary home online in the cloud, but to do everything that they need to do wherever they are, whenever they are. The book is available for $49, and that comes with lifetime access. And lifetime access is interesting for us because we don't intend to publish a second edition or a third edition of this book. We think of it as a living edition. It's another aspect of what Born Digital means. We update it every month. So as science changes, science itself changes over the next 10 years, our book will change, it will live, it will stay current, it will always be current. And if, as a student, you buy the book today, in 10 years, when you log on to your book to which you had lifetime access, the information you're going to read is going to be current information, not an outdated book. So we intend this for $149 purchase to be a lifelong learning companion for students, whether they become scientists or not. And finally, this book is natively accessible by students with disabilities. So students with disabilities don't have to have their disability offices contact us, and we don't give them a special PDF or anything like that. We've built support for all of that directly into the book as it is, and students can consume that through screen readers or other devices. We launched this book as a pilot in September. This is its first year in the market, and I'm happy to say we have more than 100 adoptions at major U.S. schools already, and that number is going to grow. For those of you who aren't familiar with the science space, that's a pretty good start for any textbook, and it's a really good start for a textbook that means to be radical. So we're moving forward and extending this concept across all the other life and physical sciences, and we're very encouraged with where we are and where we think we're going to go. I'm going to show you now just a few screenshots from the book so you get a flavor for it. I don't like to do live demos. I've had some doozies of experience over the years, so we're going to make do with screenshots. And this is the first screen a student will see when he or she logs on to the book. You know what that looks like? That looks like a book cover, which is really odd because we're trying to move beyond the book and get into the digital world. So why on earth would we have a book cover, which is a completely vestigial structure? Well, there is a reason. It's true that students are digital natives and that we wanted to create a product for them. It's also true that instructors are the decision makers, and instructors are anchored just a little bit more conservatively than students, and perhaps just a little bit more conservatively than we are. So it wouldn't have done to bring out something that was so exciting that nobody would want to use it. So we took a lot of care to make sure we packaged this exciting product in really familiar ways and made it an easy decision for instructors to say, I see. This is analogous to what I've always been using. It extends what I've always been using, but it allows me to continue to do it the way I've always done it. The book cover is just one example of that. You move on from the book cover and you get to the table of contents. Again, a familiar structure. What happens behind this table of contents to assemble these thousands of pieces of content into seamless adaptive workflows for the students is incredibly complex. But all that's hidden from the user. By the time it gets to the user, it's all shaped into a really nice and simple and familiar table of contents that they can work through, click on, and go into any of the modules. Here's a page chosen at random from one of the modules. On the left is the main learning material. As you can see, there's some text. Below that text, there's a test. So we test the students quite continually. As the student moves through and learns, we ask them to lean forward and apply their knowledge in various ways. Then there's an interactive. The student gets a simulation, gets a 3D look at what particular molecules look like. There are videos. We blend all kinds of materials into that left side of the page, but as you can see, we blend it into a simple, streamlined 1, 2, 3, 4 organized experience rather than having everything in 10 different places so that for the student, it feels very natural and very easy. On the right side, you start to see that intertextuality that I talked about. Here are all the resources that we want the student to explore beyond the basic text. On the top, you see some links to pieces we wrote that help the student understand what is happening with this topic in science in the real world today, cancer research, climate change. We continually move them from concepts up to where we want them to be, scientists. Below that, you see links to some primary literature, some classic papers from the Nature Archive, our own papers, which luckily we own, and so luckily we can give away to students, including the classic Watson and Crick paper on DNA, for example, is available through here. And we encourage students to read that directly so that they're not just learning about science, they're seeing science in action, and they're starting to form a mature understanding of how science works. At the top of the page, you can see the print button. The student presses the print button and gets a four-color, two-column, well-laid-out, printable version of this book, and I'm going to speak more about that later. At the end of the module, the student will take a test, several questions, and the results from that test will flow directly into an online gradebook that's built into the book for the instructor. So there will be hundreds of thousands of bits of data in here for the instructor, and we have analytics that help them interpret it. But the instructor can use this to keep track at all times of exactly how his or her class is progressing in understanding the material. What concepts are students having difficulty with? What concepts are they grasping? Where do I need to lecture on more? Within those concepts, which students are having more trouble? You can get feedback down to the learning objective level through this gradebook on which specific learning objectives which students are having trouble on. And there's a lot more that can be done with this information. But this is automatic. Without the instructor doing anything, with the students just working through the book, the instructor has insight into what's happening in the class. There's lots more to the book, which I'm not going to show you now. But everything that I've shown you and everything that I haven't shown you is available automatically on phones, tablets, mobile devices. That's the overview of the book. Now, as I draw to a close, I'm going to talk in a bit more detail about two case studies, I call them, technical challenges that were intense and dense and that we spent a lot of time trying to crack and which I think may be of interest to some of you. The first of those is mobility. We all know that to publish a textbook today, you have to make it available on mobile devices, on tablets. But how? Obviously, the answer is through apps. We all know that when the iPhone comes out, you have to bring out an iPhone app. When the Android comes out, you have to bring out an Android app. When some other phone comes out, you have to bring out that app too. The BlackBerry, you have to bring out a BlackBerry app. We all know that the answer to mobility is to create 75 different apps for 75 different devices because that's very sexy. But actually, as sexy as it is, it's completely unsustainable for us to bring out version after version after version of this product, new application after new application after new application. It's not sustainable for us to reinvent the basic code base again and again and again. So we set out at the beginning to find a way that we could publish across all those devices once and be confident that it was going to work for many years. And the solution that we hit upon was to publish a mobile website, not mobile applications. So our book is available through the browser online, and it's available through the browser on any mobile device. Only the version of the book that you access on any mobile device is different and completely customized to that device. The design, the shape, the layout of the page is completely customized to that device. The codec of the video is completely customized to the capabilities of that device. And the audio, the size and formats of the images are customized to that device. The kind of JavaScript, everything about the book is completely customized to that device. If you put all that together, actually we end up having hundreds of combinations of websites that we deliver to different devices so that no matter what device you use the book on, you get an experience that feels like it was designed just for your device. How did we do that? I actually don't know. The technology team did a great job of solving that problem. But I can tell you that we decided not to go with an m.dot or with a slash mobi or anything like that. It's all one URL. You sign onto that URL, our website senses your device and automatically assembles a version of the book for your device. Now, that sounds great, and it really is nifty. But there are some challenges that come along with that. I'm just briefly mention them. This idea of transcoding video and audio and of resizing images on the fly for different formats is rather complicated. So that's a problem that needs to be solved, but it is a solvable one. Coming up with multiple HTML formats for different sizes and form factors and shapes of screens is also a challenge you have to solve here. Syncing information across all these formats is really complicated, and not just the mobile formats, but I told you about the printable PDFs, but also the downloadable version of the book that you can download and store on your desktop and use when you're offline. Students, if we go back to the ease of use pillar value, students expect a seamless experience. If they take a test here, they expect it to be automatically reflected in their mobile website over there. So syncing all of that data across those different formats is also a challenge. And finally, for those of you who think deeply about SEO, having one single URL deliver multiple web versions to different devices is not something that SEO likes a lot. So you have to figure out how to do that without hurting your SEO juice. You're free to ask me during the question how we do that. And again, I'll tell you, I just don't know. But it is done. The second case study is DRM. Of course, when we move to a born digital world with our textbooks, we're also moving to a pirate's bonanza world, right? We publish our stuff online. It's so easy for people to steal and ship around it. I don't like losing revenue and having revenue undercut by piracy any more than any other publisher, so we do take that seriously. But we also want to create a product that is meaningful and exciting and reverses that apathy that students feel. And so we decided to think about DRM from a consumer's perspective. Now, we asked a few people and got into their shoes, and here's what DRM looks like from a consumer's perspective. And forgive me if I'm telling you something. You know, what DRM looks like from a publisher's perspective is I put a lot of money into this content, and I'm going to protect it so that I don't lose money. What DRM looks like from a consumer's perspective is that there are 100 students in a class. 99 of them would never consider stealing or sharing their information on some file sharing site. 99 of them are either too noble or too lazy to do that, and they just use the information as is. One student in the class is the guy or the girl who wants to steal this information and share it. And from the student's perspective, what we have done with DRM is to penalize those 99 virtuous students by giving them a really difficult experience, to penalize them for the misbehavior of the one bad guy. Right? That's what DRM looks like. You're penalizing the virtuous to prevent the non-virtuous. And in the long run, that's a funny kind of situation to be in with your customers. And it's not the situation we want it to be in. We want to create a really great experience for our virtuous users, for our good consumers, for the people who buy our products. We want them to be really happy and have the best possible experience. We also want to discourage and disincentivize the bad students from stealing. But primarily, we want to have good relationships with our good users. So what that pointed to was a very light approach to DRM and also a progressive approach to DRM. So in our online textbook, we have no DRM. There's nothing. You can take the content, and if you feel like reassembling it in any format that you want, you can do that. But when we package that content up in ways that are more organized and easier to share, then we start to layer some DRM on top. So when we let you download a PDF to print your book, then we have some DRM on top of that. 5 minutes. And when we let you download the entire book for your digital desktop edition, there we have double encryption. And we feel that as a user, because you can always go online and get a very easy experience online, you won't mind jumping through a few hoops on these secondary versions. We've always allowed you to have a place that's easy for you to access. So we try to prevent easy piracy and create good relationships with our good consumers. But actually, all that aside, that's not our DRM strategy. Our DRM strategy is quite different, is to make it very, very attractive and quite essential, in fact, for students to buy the book. Rather than disincentivizing piracy or making it difficult to pirate, we want to incentivize students to come in the door. And the main way we do that is through that testing and homework system that you saw. We only let instructors adopt our book if they are going to make that homework system part of their course and part of their grade. Right? And we have walked away, believe it or not, from some adoptions where that wasn't going to be the case. We only work with adoptions where that's going to be the case. Because if you have to be in that online gradebook to get a passing grade in your class, then you have to buy access to the book. You can get a pirated version of the content, but it's not going to help you. You also can't access all those primary literature. You can't access the data sets. You can't access any of the richness of the book. So we make it essential and attractive for you to buy the book. That's our DRM strategy. And I'm happy to tell you that our sell-through thus far has been in the 90s. Now, that's not 100, but there are 5 to 6% of students in any class who just, I guess, don't, I don't know, actually, mystifies me. But it's a lot better than 30, so we're very, very happy to be in the 90s on sell-through thus far. Finally, I'll close by talking about our distribution strategy, because I know some of you will be interested in that. We built our own platform to house this ebook because it's an integrated experience. We distribute in some familiar ways. We have access cards in college bookstores. We also have direct e-commerce. Students can come to our website and buy access to our book. We don't distribute through Apple and Amazon. If any of you are interested, I'd be happy to talk about why in the question period. We distribute directly through our own e-commerce, and we keep all the money from that. But we also have some new distribution strategies that we're working on, mainly site licenses. This is an exciting model that I think is a key model for the education space for the future. The institution makes a single payment to us, and we give content to all the students on campus. That's 100% sell-through. It's a recurring annuity, and it's a very, very good relationship for the school, for faculties, for students. We've done a few contracts like this so far, and we have some plans in place to grow this as we add chemistry and a number of other textbooks over the years. And with that, I'm happy to take, if there's time, any questions that everybody have, and I thank you for your kind attention.
Two things from an instructor's perspective. Are the instructors notified when edits are made by the authors so that we can adjust our curricula?
The question was, from an instructor's perspective, are instructors notified when we make changes to the content so that they can make changes to their curriculum? And the answer is yes. And in fact, pulling updates is a voluntary act by the professor. When we publish an update to the DNA module, for example, you'll get a note in your classroom, module 45 has been updated, here's what's been changed. Would you like to stick with your current version or would you like to move to the new version? So it'll be your choice and you'll know when it's happening and you can redesign your teaching to match.
And the other quick one is the gradebook requirement. You're not requiring us to use your gradebook as our the entire basis for our grade or our only grade book, we can just transfer those numbers into the other grade book that we use at the school, right?
That's correct. Our grade book and our tests are not meant to be the summative official tests that you apply at your school. You may run those through a learning management system or something else. They're meant to be a source of detailed, continual, instant feedback on everything that the students are learning as they progress through the book. It's information for you as the instructor.
Thank you.
Thad McElroy here. Clearly, this is an experiment, a fantastic one, and you can't make definitive statements on the finances, but what's the early talk about how you're going to measure this within the broader context of the business that you're operating?
So this is certainly a profit-making venture for us. That's our reason for going into it, and we've done our business models and our P&L, and we know what conditions we have to hit for this to be a healthily profitable business, the same kind of actually gross margin doesn't even apply here, but the same kind of profit margin that we would want out of a textbook business. And where we are right now in year one, we're on track for that. So we're pretty confident that if we continue to scale this model, it is a viable, sustainable, profitable model for textbook publishing. Of course, the top line revenue is appears lower, $49 appears lower than a $200 textbook, but when you're hitting sell-through in the 90s, of course, you end up making the same or more top-line revenue. And our cost structure is quite different. We don't have any cost of goods with the textbooks. We have a bit more. We've rolled the cost of goods actually into the cost of operating the platform, so we've moved it over into another place. And when you net all of that out, it comes out on paper to a very strong business model. We feel good about where we are on that roadmap.
Thank you.
One more question. I'm sorry, I have to take the person at the microphone. Apologize.
So as a developer who does, our clients do both web and app, I'm really curious about your decision to go with the web. So I'm just wondering if we could go into that a little bit more. So my question really is related to the concept of the hybrid app, which I don't know if everyone's familiar with, but the idea is that you have your native app and you have your web mobile website, but then there's a concept of getting the native app in the App Store, but all the content is really just from your mobile website or all of the HTML5 and all the JavaScript and CSS and all those technologies, but in your app. And I'm curious, so you sort of made two different distinctions. I'm curious if your team had a chance to look at sort of that middle line approach and what your thoughts were on that.
Right. It's a good question. Before I answer that, let me just take, since this is the last question, let me take a moment to recognize a colleague of mine, Michael Powers, who's in the audience, who's the executive product manager for this product. We've worked together on this for years, and he's a key part of this. So I just wanted to thank him in public for everything he's done. To answer your question, yes, I think that's the next step. What you're talking about plays to the advantages of apps without having the limitations. So yeah, I think that's a good direction for us to go in the future. There still is this challenge of sustainability. You still have to create many different kinds of apps for many different kinds of environments. And I'm pretty rigorous about not setting off down a path that we can't afford to be on 2 years from now. So we're happy with the mobile website strategy right now. It works. It does everything we need it to do. It does everything our users need it to do. So we'll take that step of moving to what you're talking about when I think there's a real demand from the users for that, mm-hmm. when it actually adds some value to what we're doing, and when I think I have a path for maintaining those multiple versions that we can afford.
Well, thank you very much, Vikram.